Good afternoon. My name is Carla Bellinger, and I'm the president of the board of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron. And I'd like to welcome you today to our program. It is a beautiful June day, and I am grateful in the middle of it that you are welcome to be willing to be here with us. We gather today to think about the idea of hope. And what a delightful topic that we have to look forward to with Dr. Susan McGurgan. Please silence your cell phones at this time so that we don't have any interruptions during our talk. On your tables, you will find white index cards so that as Susan is talking and a question pops into your head about hope or anything else related to hope, you can write it down. We will also have a moment after her talk for you to take and gather your thoughts, write down your questions and gather them so that after Susan has given us her talk, she will also answer all the questions that you've ever had about hope. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Mary Yanko, the salt of the earth for the community of Akron. She will give our invocation.
Good and gracious God, we awaken in our time to a universe which is holy, to creation which is not an event in the past, but a living event of the present. We enter a new mode of human presence where we are not merely observers, but where each of us is a participant in this moment of evolution. Glory to you, O God, source of all being. This great liturgy finds expression at this moment in us, gathered here in a posture of prayerful openness, with listening hearts, loving spirits, and a holy wonder. May the sacred web that unites us with each other, our God, and all creation ignite communities of light and hope throughout the earth. May we be open to the source of all being, our God, within and among us. O gracious, gentle spirit of love, your energy permeates the universe, igniting the earth with your goodness, truth, and beauty. Open our minds and hearts to a deeper awareness of our interconnectedness with you, each other, and all creation. May we experience your unique presence within the sacred web of creation. We ask this in your name. Amen.
I would like to now introduce our board member, Lynn Schott, who will introduce today's speaker.
Dr. Susan McGurgan is the director of the Lay Pastoral Ministry Program and an assistant professor of pastoral theology at the Athenaeum of Ohio, which is the home of Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Cincinnati. In addition to administrative duties of staff supervision, budget, student recruitment, advising, and adjunct faculty oversight, Dr. McGurgan teaches church history, evangelization, and capstone in the Lay Pastoral Ministry Program, and homiletics in the Permanent Diaconate Program. She is a member of the Catholic Association of Teachers of Homiletics and the Academy of Homiletics, and serves on a variety of institutional committees in the Archdiocese of Cincinnati. Susan has presented preaching and lecture training workshops at the parish, diocesan, and national level, and has published and presented papers on homiletics and preaching formation. Current areas of interest include the language of preaching, the intersection of theology and arts, preaching hope, diaconal preaching formation, and the history of women in evangelization and proclamation. A native of Oklahoma, Susan is the descendant of pioneer women who lived on the promise of hope as they created homes and family life in sod houses, oil boom camps, land-run homesteads, and Dust Bowl-era farms. Susan holds an honors history degree from Oklahoma State University and completed 3 years of doctoral work in Ancient History and Classics at the University of Cincinnati. She earned an MA in Religion from the Athenaeum of Ohio and a Doctorate of Ministry and Preaching from Seabury Western Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. Although she did not finish her degree at the University of Cincinnati, she did meet her husband, Andrew, of 35 years, in the Classics Department reading room, so it counts as time well spent. She and Andrew have three sons, Robert, Kevin, and Patrick. Let's welcome Dr. Susan McGurgan.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be here, and I very much appreciate the invitation from Carla Bellinger, who is a friend of mine from CATH and from the Academy of Homiletics. This is actually my second visit to Akron. My first visit was in 1978, when my boyfriend and I were on our way to Connecticut to visit with his parents. And we stopped in Akron to crash on the couches of friends of friends of friends. And the great romantics that we were, I turned to him at one point and said, "So where is this relationship going? Are we going to get married or what?" And the great romantic that he is said, "Yeah, I guess that was always the intent." And I said, "So are we engaged?" And he said, "Sure, why not?" So I regard Akron as the most romantic city in the world. And I am very glad to be back here. We're going to be talking about hope. As you heard, I was born and raised in Oklahoma, and it's a land of red clay and tall thermometers. I was a city girl, but I have pioneer DNA on both sides of the family. I believe that the landscapes of our childhood shape us in profound and sometimes unexpected ways, for good or ill. And the stories that we hear around the dining room table, the faded pictures that look back at us from the family albums, teach us as profoundly as any textbooks can. So I had two sets of great-grandparents who traveled west in wagons, and they settled on the high plains in northwest Kansas. It is a vast place. There are very few interruptions there. It is crowned with a sky that seems to bend towards the far horizon. And on the prairie, you can see as far as your eyesight and the curvature of the earth allows you to see. It teaches you to have a distant gaze, and it teaches you a lot about the bigness of God. It's a place that can confront you with your own edges and your own limits. To be honest with you, I have always found it both beautiful and liberating and terrifying. It's a land of extremes. It is hot in the summer, and it is bone-rattling cold in the winter. And it has a prevailing wind that makes everything kind of bend towards Nebraska. So we had Henry and Eliza, and we had Clement and Minnie, who both built sod houses on the banks near Prairie Dog Creek. And they cut building blocks from the earth itself because the land would give them no stones or no trees for building. On the other side of my family, my great-grandfather Albert staked his fortune in the land runs in Oklahoma. And along with 20,000 other people at high noon when the gun went off, he raced for one of the 160-acre homesteads that was up for grabs. For Albert, life was always a very hard gamble with a stacked deck. Nothing about that fact ever seemed to change for him. He always lived just this side of hope. And he always dreamed that somehow his wanderings through the deserts and through the valleys would lead him to the promised land. His son, my grandfather Cliff, worked as a roustabout in the oil boom fields of early day Oklahoma. These boom towns were places named Whizbang and Slick and Drumright. And they rose overnight in a farmer's field when the wells came in, and then they kind of faded into shadows when the wells tapped out and it was time to move on. I think it's very easy today, it's very tempting to look back on the past and smooth out all the rough edges, to polish up the struggle, to make everything look like a high gloss, to kind of sentimentalize everything. But in truth, there was very little that was romantic about being a pioneer or surviving the Dust Bowl or working in a boom town and trying to create a stable family life. It was dirty and it was inconvenient and it was incredibly risky. Human life was fragile. And these ventures failed as often as they succeeded. It was very difficult for the young and the weak. Many died along the way, and a lot of people returned to a less marginal life. I think that sometimes you have to leave home in order to see home with any perspective. And when I grew up and I moved away and I started to listen to different stories, and I started to hear different songs sung in a different key, I began to see my own story through a new perspective, through a new lens. And I discovered that despite all of the difficulties, and I think maybe because of the difficulties, I realized that the people looking back at me from the pages of my family album were people whose lives forever inclined towards hope. And when I discovered that, I've been fascinated by the concept of hope and the reality of hope ever since. The church teaches us that there are three theological virtues: faith, hope, and charity, or love, if you will. And I always think that a theological virtue sounds so abstract, you know, like Pelagianism or soteriology or the scholastic school. What does that even mean? And what does a theological virtue have to do with Whizbang, Oklahoma? You know? Don't let the name fool you. Theological virtues are the very stuff of life. These are the bedrocks of our souls, and they give life to all of the other virtues. God places these theological virtues deep within us. Faith, hope, and charity give us the ability to act as God's children. They are God's promise to us that the Holy Spirit is working in our lives. So, hope in particular responds to the aspiration for happiness that God has placed within us. This is an amazing truth that I think we don't say often enough. God wants us to be happy. And God wants us to be happy to the extent that He has put the aspiration for that, the desire, the yearning, the longing, deep within us, buried in our marrow, if you will. So for God, it's not just enough that we be moral, or that we be good, or that we be devout. God wants us to be happy. And hope is what speaks to that. The prophet Jeremiah said, "I know the plans I have laid for you, plans for good and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." Paul's letter to the Romans speaks of a hope that does not disappoint. And 1 Peter reminds us, God has caused us to be born again with a living hope. So our Christian story is one of hope. But I think it's important that we know what this hope is. It's not optimism. It's not unicorns dancing on rainbows. It's not a Catholic version of the prosperity gospel. Christian hope, that theological virtue that God embeds within us, is something gritty. It has rough edges and deep roots. It teaches a distant gaze. and it talks to us about the bigness of God. This is hope that was born in a crushing death and in the echoing silence of an empty tomb. And it is a radical challenge to our culture that we can look on this death and say, this is not the final word. So hope. Our history is filled with it. Our prophets proclaim it. Our sacred texts celebrate it. We talk about hope in our liturgy. Our sacraments make it real and present to us. And the church teaches us that it is so vital to our being that God has fused it into our beings. So why is it that we so often feel hopeless? We sometimes feel like the walking wounded, bruised and limping, beaten up by worry, by the economy, by illness, by loss and death, by injustice or poverty, even by the political discourse and the dissension within the church itself. We know firsthand that marriages fail, that children leave their childhood faith, that sometimes friends betray us, that health is precious and precarious. So how can we tap into this deep source of hope that the church promises? How do we proclaim a gospel of hope in a world that so often seems hopeless? We long for evidence that Christ is at work in our lives, sustaining us, holding us up. We thirst for a drink of water from those deep wells that promise a rich harvest. And instinctively, we know that we have to find a way to connect with that God-shaped puzzle piece in us. What I'm going to do this morning is talk to you about three things that I've learned from my ancestors. There are a lot of ways to talk about hope. I will not talk about more ways than I'm going to talk about, but I am going to share with you three things that I've learned to embrace the wilderness experience, to take time to remember, and to understand and respect the power of words. Ezekiel 37 says this: "The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a wilderness. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. He asked me, 'Son of man, can these bones live?' I said, 'Sovereign Lord, you alone know.' Then he said to me, 'Prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones: I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life.'" Who among us hasn't had that desert experience, that sense of abandonment and loneliness, the feeling that all of the joy and the vitality has really been sucked out of you, leaving in its place just a pile of dry bones? Moses and Elijah and all of the prophets of Israel, Jesus, John the Baptist, Christian mystics from all eras have all been drawn to the wilderness. They've all been drawn there for inspiration, for prayer, for silence. And they looked out across that empty landscape and they understood that there are actually two deserts, two wildernesses: the wilderness that burns by day and freezes by night, and then that inner desert, that inner desert in which each of us at one time or another must go. Left alone in the desert, left alone in the wilderness, the noontime sun can blind you. It evaporates water. It blisters unprotected skin. It is a desolate place. Too wild. Too empty. And in the dark, that emptiness becomes terrifying, filled with the rustle of snakes and the sharp glitter of the stars in the sky. But you know, the inner desert can be just as dangerous. The wilderness within is a place of purging, of letting go, of stripping down, emptying out, encountering God. And the evangelists knew how important this experience was. For Mark, the experience in the wilderness was so important that he begins the story of Jesus not with angelic visitors, not with a pregnant girl, not with rich gifts or exotic visitors, but with the desert. Mark's gospel hurls us, ready or not, into the wilderness, where everything we encounter either bites or burns or stings. So the lesson here is that even if you're the Son of God, there are times when the desert is all you can see. Doesn't really seem fair, does it? The truth is, no matter where we live, no matter how far we journey, no matter how long we travel, no matter which travel guide we use, at some point in our lives, we will find ourselves in the wilderness. Whether we go there deliberately, whether we are hurled there, one day we'll find ourselves in the middle of the desert, blinded, disoriented, terrified, tempted, sunburned, and just about dying of thirst. The single mom, stretched so thin that she almost becomes invisible, knows the wilderness of exhaustion and guilt. The child standing just beyond the edges of the playground alone knows the desert of loneliness. The trusted accountant, dangerously in debt, knows the wilderness called temptation. Some of the harshest and most solitary landscapes don't appear on any map, and you don't have to cross the prairie to find them. They are right at the end of your street, or they're around the corner. So do we close our eyes and pretend they don't exist, or do we lean into that experience as Jesus did and see what we can learn from the wilderness, because the wilderness has lessons for us. Anyone who has spent any time wandering in a desert landscape knows that it is both perilous and beautiful. It's risky, it's unexpected, it's empty, and yet at the same time, it is filled with possibilities. My grandparents discovered that above all, the wilderness is a place of surprises. For despite all of the appearances to the contrary, the wilderness, the desert, those rocky places are actually filled with life. The withered plant, desiccated and dry, has roots that reach deep into the ground. A handful of soil, baked and brown, actually contains thousands of seeds just waiting for the chance to bloom. When we're hurled into the desert, we may find that our pain, our loss, our addictions, our triumphs, even our failures, no longer define us, because the vast emptiness
allows us to see just how small they are and how big God is. If we can embrace it, that emptiness can teach us a distant gaze, and it can give us the time to discover that the hollowness that we feel inside us is not a void, but rather a throne, a space for the Holy of Holies, the presence of the living God. The high plains, the rocky outcrops, the deserts that you find along your journey, these difficult places, as challenging as they are, change our perspective. They empty out our emotional clutter. They interrupt our habits. And these liminal spaces give us the freedom to let go of our old burdens, our old ways of being, our burial cloths. They allow us to embrace new beginnings and to vision new endings. Wilderness experiences can be opportunities where something new and surprising can be born. It takes courage. All births and new beginnings do. Can these bones live? Sovereign Lord, only you alone know. Prophesy to these bones and say to them, "Dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life." We turn the pages of our family albums and we see things like wedding invitations, birth announcements, clippings of boys who went to war too young, photos of friends and relatives and family picnics that we have long forgotten. These are mementos that mark the seasons of our lives, those seasons of mourning and celebration, of welcoming and letting go. And they're captured for us, saved by chance sometimes, or a convenient camera. And in these memories, hope can become real. The prophet Isaiah said, "Can a woman forget her nursing child? Have no compassion for the son of her womb. And even if she forgets, I will not forget you. See, I have carved your name on the palm of my hand." Memory is our ability to store and encode and retain information. And memories are connections, not just in an emotional or a psychological way, but in a biochemical way. Memories are connections, literally. Our brains are composed of over 100 billion neurons, and they're all wired together in a web of connections, and we communicate through this complex web. And memory is a vital part of what makes us human. And yet, surprisingly, memory, what it is, how it functions, how we use it, remains rather elusive even to scientists. It's a mystery in many ways, even to science. But without memory, we would be bombarded every day with new experiences and new information that we had no way to process, no way to encode, no way to learn from, and no way to retrieve. A woman whose mother suffered from Alzheimer's said, "I watched her disappear. Everything and everyone she ever knew were erased as her memory was lost to her and eventually to me. It was the most terrible thing I have ever seen." Memory and hope are intimately connected. like an internal prophet. Our memory says to us, the way things are today are not the way things have to be. Okay? Memory can take us to another time, another place, another chance. Memory of spring thaws and abundant harvests gave my grandparents the hope to continue on. Memories of being landless gave Albert the courage to try again, and the hope to try again after that when he failed. Anne Frank, remembering her very happy childhood, wrote from behind the wall, "It's a wonder I haven't abandoned all my ideals. They seem so absurd and impractical. And yet I cling to those memories because I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart. It's utterly impossible for me to build my life on a foundation of chaos, suffering, death. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that one day may destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions, and yet when I look at the sky and I remember, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better, that this cruelty too shall pass, that peace and tranquility will return once more." Personal memory can be a powerful conduit of hope, but not all personal memories awaken goodness. Memories of a lonely childhood or an abusive relationship or tragic loss can sear and burn and leave us nursing wounds that we think may never heal. Some memories, given the right trigger, can come upon us with the brutality of an airstrike and leave us gasping. Some memories produce such bitter fruit that we want to plow them under, root, stem, and all. But as people of faith, we don't have to rely on simply our own memories. As God's people, we have access to memories beyond our own. We're promised by God that we will not be left orphans. And in that promise, each of us has become part of a grand circle of memories, connected web by web, connection by connection, to the communion of saints and the great memories of our faith and our journey. The church is a community of dynamic memory, and in that memory, hope. St. Augustine and St. John of the Cross spoke about this. They spoke about the connection of memory and hope. It places us in the covenant. It places us in the time of the covenant, and it launches us to the future. Pope Francis tells us that the joy of evangelization always arises from grateful remembrance. The disciples never forgot that moment that they encountered Jesus. The apostles never forgot that moment. Jesus touched their hearts. And together with Jesus, this remembrance is made present to us in this great cloud of witnesses. And so as a believer, we are essentially one who remembers. When we remember God's saving presence in the past, leading the Israelites out of Egypt, breaking people free from bondage, Jesus calling Lazarus forth from the tomb, healing the man born blind, then we are free to celebrate today, no matter what pain endures. Memory allows us to embrace hope right here and right now, even when the crops fail, even when the drought continues and the dust rains down, even when the well runs dry and it's time to move on.
The men and women who served in the trenches of the civil rights movement, the remembrance of God's redemptive action in the past and their absolute conviction of God's liberating action in the future allowed them to transform the barriers of prejudice, of hatred, and of injustice into hope. And that hope then transformed police dogs and water cannons and jail time into an expression of victory. When families gather at a time of sorrow, one of the first things we do is we begin to tell stories. We call on the memory of love, and as we do that, we begin to affirm God's goodness, even through our tears. Our faith remembers the truth, even if today lies. Our faith promises healing, even as we adjust our bandages. Our faith calls us worthy, even when we fail. And it is in that assurance of grace, carried in the memory of the faithful, that allows us to triumph, even as the world is announcing that we're defeated. So this is our hope. This is our hope. Through our tears, through our exiles, through our pain, we remember and we can find joy. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars, we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us to sing songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of Zion when in a foreign land? "If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy." What words are powerful enough, beautiful enough, evocative enough for us to speak of hope? My grandfather was a Methodist pastor, and before he would step into the pulpit, he would say this psalm: "Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer." My uncle and my grandfather were Methodist pastors who were known for their preaching ability, and my mother was a teacher and a poet, and some of my earliest memories were of writing poetry with her, and from these people, I learned the power of words. Communications experts say that we speak approximately 16,000 words a day. That adds up to 112,000 words a week and over 5 million words in a year. And we don't spend a lot of time analyzing these words or reflecting on them. But a word is a living organism. It's powerful. It's capable of changing, spreading, influencing the world. Words have power, and we know this instinctively. Marketers bombard us with words. Words that are newer, fresher, brighter, sexier, better. Until the words that we hear really have no meaning at all. Facebook, Twitter, texts, Instagram. Our devices buzz and chirp and bleep and vibrate in their enthusiasm to tell us that we have more words waiting for us. Now, urgently, quickly. We are literally drowning in words. And yet the more we fill ourselves up with words that have no nutrition in them, the hungrier we are for words that have meaning, for the word, you know? Scientists have long noted that as humans, we have a propensity towards the negative, that negative images, negative words, capture our attentions more powerfully than positive ones. And this may well be a holdover from our hunting and gathering days, when if you didn't pay attention to danger, you simply didn't live to hunt again. So I would encourage you to think about the power of the words that you use. Imagine the hope that we could offer if we held back those words that demean, the words that exclude and divide. And imagine the spark that we could ignite if we shared our experiences, our memories, our desert experiences, and the memories of love and hope that we have with people, with words that fostered hope. I believe this is the great appeal of Pope Francis. He speaks several languages, but the most powerful language he speaks is the language of hope. When you hear him speak, his words are simple, they're concrete, they're welcoming, they're clear. His words attract and delight. His words paint pictures of hope that we simply want to drown in. We couldn't quit listening to him if we tried. Emily Dickinson wrote this: "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without words and never stops at all." I would invite you to sing the tune without words, to reflect on the stories that you find in your own family album, to reflect on your desert experiences, to rediscover the power of language, to reflect on that. Pope Francis tells us that the Lord does not disappoint people who take this journey. Whenever we embrace hope, whenever we take a step towards Jesus, we discover that he is already there, waiting for us with open arms. Thank you.
We'll take about a few minutes, Susan, if you want to relax for a few minutes. Thank you for that message. I feel like the feathers in my soul are already fluttering up a little. You know, sometimes the Holy Spirit just sort of bowls us up like that, so thank you, Susan, for that. A station identification announcement. If you have cards with questions, I know that Susan can give you every solution to every one of your hopeful questions. So please write down some questions, and Mike will gather them when you've got them. When you're done with your question, just raise it up, and he will come by and take it for you. In the meantime, while we're waiting for that, our next First Friday luncheon will be on Friday, again the second Friday of the month, July 10th. Our speaker will be Dr. Brian Starks. Brian sent me a whole box of his study from Notre Dame. They were on the table if you took one. He was at the Institute for Church Life until last September when he moved to Kennesaw State, and he's a professor there. I would say he's a young man, but I don't know. He's one of those kind of young men that will probably at 70 still look like a young man. So Brian is a very enthusiastic speaker, and you have a sneak preview about his talk from his little booklet that is there free on the table. If you didn't get one, I think there are still some more out there. Also, if you are listening to a podcast on our website, we invite you to join us in person. You can make reservations by sending a check to the First Friday Club and emailing your desire to join us, or you can call our phone number each month. If you sign up on a monthly basis, please let us know by the Tuesday before the Friday meeting. If you know anyone who needs a message of hope, and that's probably 99% of this world, Susan's podcast will be on our website, and please email to other people and say, "Hey, you should have heard this. I wish you were there. Listen to this message of hope." And if you want to hear it again, and this may be one of our most rebroadcast podcasts, because today you may not need a message of hope, but tomorrow you might, or next week you might. So just sort of bookmark this podcast on among your bookmarks. Also, we have cards that we like to keep track of people who we haven't seen before. If you're not already on our mailing list, please raise your hand and we'll give you an orange card, orangish yellow card, so that you can get a notification of what's coming up. Do we have any first-time attendees here? I'd like to recognize... No? Have we got anybody who's been here more than 10 years? Raise your hand. All right. Well, let's all give all of our long-term attendees a big hand. Now, this month I can't recognize any of the students because they're all having fun somewhere else. Also, we have a lot of board members here. Would the board members all stand up? And then we'd like to recognize you for your service to this organization. Please give them all a big hand. And if you have any thoughts about speakers or ideas, those are the people to talk to. And they will gladly listen to your thoughts. Is there anyone here who's had a family member graduate this spring? Raise your hand. Whatever you had done in that, let's give them a round of applause. Board members, is there anything that I should have said that I've forgotten? All right, Mike, are we ready? All right.
How do you see the other virtues of faith and charity supporting the virtue of hope?
I am not a theologian. No.
I think they're all interrelated. I think each interconnects. I think, for instance, fostering a sense of hope leads us to reach out in charity and love. When we reach out, we find ourselves imbued with hope. So I do think that they're all interrelated. I think taking a step in one direction leads to surprising spiritual growth and insights in every direction.
How does one inspire young people to embrace the wilderness?
Yeah, I think that's very difficult. Carla and I were actually talking about that last night, about some of these young people have never lived in a world in which we weren't at war in the Mideast. You know, some of the young people in high school now have only known high alert for terrorism. They've only seen the church kind of being in this morass, or this ennui, or Catholics internecine fighting. I think that's a challenging question. I believe in the power of storytelling. I do believe that when we talk to young people about our experiences, they may not act as if they're listening, but they listen to everything we say. More importantly, they listen to everything we do. So if there is any disconnect between what we profess to believe and our actions, then we're dead in the water. So I think that many of them are experiencing incredible debt that they have from college. My own sons are just swimming in debt. I have no idea how they will ever marry and get out from under that. There's a cynicism, I think, at play. But I think we just continue to tell our story. We continue to act as people of faith and charity and justice. And hopefully they are watching. I think that your speaker next month may have some insights into that. So I would encourage you to bring that question to him because he's an expert.
Could you reflect upon the Blessed Virgin Mary as being the exemplification of hope?
Oh, wow. She's such, for me, a figure of hope. A person who, a very real woman to me, who had more than her share of wilderness experiences. And I think, what was her reaction to this? She meditated on them. She reflected on what lessons were there for her. I believe that Mary is
a wonderful figure of hope, an anchor of hope. I do love, I had never heard of this devotion before, but I guess it's a favorite of Francis's, but Mary the Undoer of Knots, when he was working on his degree, he saw this painting of Mary depicted as the Undoer of Knots, and now this he's kind of fostering this devotion. I love that image of Mary busy working to help us undo the knots in our lives. And I find that an incredibly hopeful image. I have a little holy card of Mary, the Undoer of Knots, on my desk, and she does give me great hope. So I believe that Mary is someone that we can hold out to other people who are struggling. And I think it's important to hold out a real Mary, not some glossed up, beautiful, you know, in the sense the kind of painted holy card Mary, but the real Mary, who gave birth, who suffered, who watched her son die, and yet through it all remained a faith-filled and hope-filled servant of the Lord. That Mary offers real hope.
You gave us a bit of an insight into this question already, but what practices do you use personally to keep hope in your heart when you face challenging times?
I didn't talk about gratitude, but gratitude, I think, and hope are so intimately connected. Last year, I took on a spiritual discipline of every day writing down three things that I was grateful for. And I started it at first just kind of as a, you know, kind of like oatmeal, it's good for you, but maybe not all that fun. But as I continued, and the reason I picked three is because it's easy to find one thing every day to be grateful for. But when you have to find three, you really have to do some digging. Because some days, just to be honest, are so bad that trying to find three things to be grateful for is hard. And some days it was, I was grateful that I didn't, you know, hit somebody, or I was, you know, I was grateful that I remembered to feed the cat, or I was grateful I defrosted the chicken. But as I got more into this discipline, I realized that actually those are things I should be grateful for. You know, I have meat to put on the table. I have the cutest cat in the world. I was able to hold my temper. I highly recommend this discipline to pick a number, but it has to be more than one or two. What are you grateful for? And to write it down. And to look at that, because what it does is it starts to open your eyes to all of the blessings that you have. You know, all of the things that we find so inconvenient. 99% of the world would get down on their knees and praise Jesus that they had it. So to start a gratitude journal, to me, it is the greatest way to foster hope. I highly recommend it. And then to start to reflect on the relationship between gratitude and hope. It's profound.
How does one discern when to adjust hope relative to unmet expectations? Sometimes one can be in the desert for a very long time.
Yeah, that is really true. When you really start to learn the stories of people's lives, honestly, it's amazing that some people are still walking around. You know, there are people and families that just bear such crushing burdens. And those burdens are not temporary, they're chronic and enduring. And I have to say, I have never had to endure that kind of burden, that long term where you feel you're never going to get out of it. I think you have to be very proactive in asking for help. I think we stoic along quite a bit. You know, I'm okay, I don't need help. And I think that if you are in the desert and you don't see the end of it, to reach out for those lifelines, to allow people to help you. There is no shame in asking for help. There's no weakness in that. the prize at the end doesn't go to the strongest. It goes to those who are faithful. And I think prayer, opening yourself up to prayer, opening yourself up to others, and just know that the communion of saints is praying with you. And sometimes that can bring a sense of consolation. It doesn't ease the tension, and it doesn't solve the problems, but it does let you know that you're not alone, and sometimes that can offer us light glimmer.
In the face of so many seemingly hopeless issues throughout the world, and particularly, this questioner said, in the case of climate change and the seeming lack of willingness to act, where do we look for hope?
Yeah, I know. I sometimes wonder if our grandchildren, you know, what if I ever have any grandchildren? Do you hear that, boys? What they're going to inherit? I do, and I know that's something that our young people struggle with. I'm hoping that the new encyclical that Francis is putting out will open up that conversation and will empower Catholics to start embracing this issue and to talk about it and to look for those solutions. What would you say? You know, how would you answer that question? Some of you may have more insights into this than I do. Yes.
God please. Always provides. He sends someone your way.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be alert to that.
Be alert to what God provides. Yes.
Something happens your way. He doesn't abandon us.
He will not leave us orphans. And I do take comfort in that. Thank you.
Would you be willing to share the journey of faith of your family in Methodism to Catholicism?
In 30 seconds or less. You know, they talk about... I always feel that I was actually a Catholic baby who was kidnapped by Methodist gypsies and raised apart. When I was in college, we went to a different church every week, depending on which cute fraternity boys were at that church. And I went to the Catholic church, and it was as if I had been, it was just like, where have you been all my life? I just felt at home. I felt at peace. I loved the liturgy. I loved everything about it. And 20 years later, I actually bit the bullet and became a Catholic. And along the way, I married a nice Irish boy, so that helped too. Yeah.
Susan, thank you for your wisdom and for delighting us and for giving us hope in this world. I would like to now introduce our board member, Jackie Vigno, from our Diocesan Youth and Young Adult Ministry, who will lead us in our closing prayer.
As we come before as members of God's great cloud of witnesses, let's take a few seconds. Let's come and lift up our hearts of surrender as we are people of the walking wounded. And let us lift up our hearts of gratitude as we are those who have experienced God's hope in our lives. Just a few words from Pope Francis.